The following podcast is a presentation of the Washington College of Law at American University. Any unauthorized use or distribution is strictly prohibited.
Good morning. I want to welcome all of you to our conference today on the prevention on the torture. This is a conference that takes place in the framework of our founders' celebration. But those of you who are not members of our community, perhaps it's interesting for you to know that we were created in 1896, our law school, when women were not allowed into the law schools or into a practice of the legal profession. Among other reasons, because both by nature, end quote, they were considered unsuited to understand the complexities of the law. Our two founding mothers, Ellen Spencer Massey and Emma Julia, thought that it was an essential condition to achieve equality and a better society to create an educational institution that will educate women lawyers and men into the important values of the rule of law. And for that purpose, they created this institution in 1896. Their message had many connotations. For example, the power of imagination, the idea that we can imagine a better society and bring it to relaxation. The need to fight what is considered, quote, the conventional wisdom of the time, end quote, that the role that all of us have to play in achieving that transformation. Their belief in the rule of law and in the perfectibility of democracy and its institution. And also I would add, in they believe also in the universality of many issues facing humankind, including the struggle for gender equality. Our founding mothers in the beginning provided expert advice also to the struggle of women in other countries on earth. Now, inspired by that very compelling and powerful message, we organized during the spring only over 60 conferences, attracting more than 10,000 judges, activists, educators, to explore the fundamental issues facing humankind. We're honored then, in the framework of that Founders celebration, to co-sponsor this important event on the prevention of torture with APT. And we welcome this important non-governmental organization that has been working since 1927 to prevent torture. And APT has put its accent and its contribution in the prevention of torture. And through its many activities, has stressed, for example, the value of unannounced visits, training, and conferences like this one that allow us to share experiences that will achieve the commonly held goal of imagining and bringing to realization the whole situation where we would not have torture. So we're very pleased to co-sponsor with APT this important conference. It is also so that in the past, the law schools were the only ones teaching and doing research and storing the result of their research in libraries. And now we live in a situation where other institutions perform a similar role. And then it is very important to challenge these artificial barriers that conspire against the possibilities of being very effective here. And that's why conferences and joint projects between academia and the civil society are very relevant. We are it's very relevant also as we talk about torture and the prevention of torture. Because academia and the civil society could then look at the different issues involved in this very serious problem facing humans. Again, through our collaboration with APT, and we a year ago started planning this conference, we thought what we want is, again, to stress this idea of prevention. How do we go about it? And the structure of this conference reflects that purpose. The idea was to convoke well-known and renowned scholars, academics, practitioners, people from civil law society, and put our brains together and see how we can contribute to that common goal. And in this conference, we're going to explore the different issues involved, the legal, the cultural, the training, and so on, focusing, as I said before, in prevention. Again, when I look at the founding manuscript, I think that perhaps their message continues to be valid. Thinking in terms of universality, all of us who have worked in the regional or international supervisory organ know how good examples are play a very important role, and good more, how negative examples are not restricted simply to a domain and to a location. And that for that purpose is identifying both that could contribute to achieve our common goal. And again, I hope that this conference will be a step in that direction, analyzing and sharing experiences that could promote our commonly shared vision. I want to thank the experts, colleagues who are here. We tremendously value your presence, and we look forward to your participation. Let me also say that we are very much indebted to Jennifer De Laurentiis, who coordinates our project on culture here. And Jennifer is responsible, of course, for all the bad things these days. But I'm sure you will switch to that, and you would not be here had it not been from our side for her participation. So thank you very much, Jennifer. Then I want also to thank our students. You're going to be recorded, so be careful with what you say, and we're going to distribute the result of this interview. And again, the hopeful grants a human rights brief. And again, they are committed in spite of the pressure of being a lot of here, and they put their time and their passion into the promotion of important values in human rights. So we have this the superb cooperation of our students, and we're grateful for them. Well, without further ado, I want to invite Mark Thompson to come here to the podium. And again, we want to thank ATT and him personally for the sponsorship of this talk. Thank you.
Let me start with a few words of thanks. On behalf of the Association for the Prevention of Torture, otherwise known as APT, I'd very much like to thank the Washington Torture Law, in particular its dean, Tyler Grossman, and the Special Assistant, Jennifer Lorenz, for their co-organization and hosting of this important conference. I'm also very grateful for the preparatory work of our UN Legal Program Officer, Marina Narvez, who started preparing for this meeting with some of the panelists today back in October 2007. We are very fortunate to have together some of the world's leading experts on torture prevention, and I would therefore like to thank our panelists and moderators for their contributions and participation today. Finally, I would also like to say how pleased we are to see such a large conference audience representing a wide spectrum of interests from apparently the military, political, judicial, academic, and NGO spheres of society. We hope you will pose challenging questions and propose interesting responses to the issues raised today. Let me move on to the significance of the timing and the venue of the conference. This conference needed to happen now and here in Washington. Too long, we have witnessed with despair wrong policy decisions on the treatment and interrogation of persons suspected of terrorism by the previous U.S. administration and their allies. This has been a major setback of international proportion for protecting the rights of all persons deprived of their liberty, in particular from the horrors of torture and other treatment. Fortunately, as we all know, the US government has already indicated that it wants to correct these wrongs. Executive Order 13491 of January 22nd, 2009, on ensuring lawful interrogations, for example, makes for very reassuring reading. Opportunities therefore present themselves for all of us to move forward with the prevention of torture and other options. However, how can we do that in a well-informed, coherent, and coordinated manner? Hopefully, today's conference in Washington will be a stable stepping stone to that global goal. In addition to Claudio Grossman's comments, let me add a few words on this preventive approach to torture. It is worthwhile stressing the preventive approach to torture as compared to policies of denunciation and redress. The preventive approach is to expose the causes of torture and then find solutions to prevent further violations to take place. It is different as it encompasses a proactive approach to address the causes of torture, usually in cooperation with authorities, to find measures and mechanisms to avoid further abuse. Therefore, more emphasis is given to enabling legal systems to function correctly and to deterrence, rather than denunciation, naming and shaming, which are very worthwhile, but different human rights protection strategies. A few words on the logic of the conference of the program today. As reflected in our rich conference program, there are many issues to consider to prevent torture, such as, are torturers punished for their criminal acts? Do detained persons have access to lawyers of their choice? How are authorities trained to arrest and interrogate? As any prevention strategy will only be truly effective with a combined response to these and many more matters, we have grouped the presentations and discussions under three panels, which reflect three interrelated fronts of possible actions. Firstly, how can law protect detained persons from torture? Secondly, how can practices of detention be challenged and reformed? And thirdly, how can opening places of detention and expert monitoring prevent abuses? In conclusion then, let me clarify what we see as the three objectives of today's conference. Firstly, for all of us to be better informed of the preventive approach to torture and the variety of elements to such an approach. Secondly, to foster improved coherence in our strategies to prevent torture. And thirdly, facilitate increased coordination between individuals, organizations, academics, human agencies, governmental authorities to pursue the solutions that will bring us progress. If this can have some eventual influence in the USA, this will be a welcome bonus. However, let me finally clarify that we do not intend for today's conference to refer solely to the USA. I shall now listen to all of you with great interest and will attempt to draw some conclusions with Claudio at the end of today's proceedings. Thank you for your attention, and I now invite the panel experts and moderators to explore in further detail the matters that require our attention for this conference, provide clear and convincing solutions and programs for the prevention of torture.
So many people who have labored with issues of human rights around the world, particularly with the issue of torture. My name is Rick Wilson. I'm director of the International Human Rights Law Clinic here at the law school and also teach international law subjects. For the past 5 years, I and students who have worked with me in the clinic have represented detainees at Guantanamo Bay. Guantanamo has become an icon in the United States, a symbol with regard to abuse and torture. And our first panel this morning addresses a question I hope is not rhetorical, which is, are adequate legal frameworks in place at the domestic level? Having labored in this field myself for these years, I am somewhat skeptical, at least as far as the answers that law has offered to the detainees at Guantanamo Bay. First, a mention of statistics. Of the 790 men detained at Guantanamo Bay over time, there have been 3 trials before military commissions, 1 guilty plea of those three. 2 of the men have been released after going home. Of the men who used the process of habeas corpus to address their detention, only 23 have been ordered released, including a large group of Uyghurs from China. And you may have seen last week that the D.C. Court of Appeals overturned the order for their release, holding that only the executive had the power to order such release. One wonders what the powers of the courts are. In my view, the battle in the courts has been the triumph of process, the triumph of abusive process by government lawyers who have thrown everything they can into the path of those of us who have attempted to bring these stories into court to tell them. It has not hindered, though, I think, the efforts of lawyers to tell those stories. And many of the stories about Guantanamo Bay come from lawyers themselves who have taken their clients' stories and told them in the world. Many of the detainees have been released, and many of them have told their stories that document the abuses of Guantanamo and other places around the world. But I'm left with a sense of frustration. These are probably the hardest cases I've ever been involved in. And I am mindful of the writings of an American legal historian who said, the better the society, the less law there will be. In heaven, there will be no law, and the lion will lie down with the lamb. In hell, there will be nothing but law, and due process will be meticulously observed. So, with that framework, I will introduce our speakers in the order in which they will speak. And once I have introduced them, we'll just go through the order. I will ask each person to just speak after the proceeding. First, and I am not going to go through the long bios that are in your materials for this morning. If I did, it would take the rest of the time, given the dimensions of our speaker's experience. Our first speaker will be Manfred Novak. Since 1992, he's been director of the Ludwig Boltzmann Institute for Human Rights in Vienna, and since 2004, UN Special Rapporteur on Torture. Since January 2007, he is a professor for international human rights protection at the University of Vienna, and since 2008, visiting professor and Swiss chair on human rights at the Graduate Institute of Geneva. He is the author of more than 400 publications. I say that with awe as an academic myself, in the fields of constitutional, administrative, and international law, with a focus on fundamental human rights. Diane Ortlicker. is a professor of international law and co-director with me of the Center for Human Rights and Humanitarian Law here at the Washington College of Law. From 1995 to 2004, she served as faculty director of the law school's War Crimes Research Office, which has provided legal assistance to international criminal tribunals since 1995. She's been described by the Washington Diplomat as one of the world's leading authorities on war crimes tribunals, and has lectured and written extensively on the scope of state obligations to address mass atrocities. In September 2004, Professor Ornlicker was appointed by the United Nations Secretary General as independent expert to prepare an updated set of principles for the protection and promotion of human rights through action to combat impunity. Ambassador Luis Gallegos is a member of the United Nations Committee Against Torture and Other Cruel, Inhuman, and Degrading Treatment and Punishment since 2007, and was reelected in 2011. He is a career member of the Foreign Service of Ecuador, having served in Spain, Bulgaria, El Salvador, and Australia. He's also been permanent representative of Ecuador to the United Nations in Geneva and New York, and at present, he is ambassador of Ecuador to the United States. Claudio Grossman is my boss. He is the dean of the American University Washington College of Law. Dean Grossman is chair of the United Nations Committee Against Torture and a member of the Commission for the Control of Interpol's Files. He was a member of the Inter-American Commission on Human Rights from 1993 to 2001, where he served in numerous capacities, including president twice and special rapporteur on the rights of women and the special rapporteur on the rights of indigenous populations. Dean Grossman is also the author of numerous publications regarding international law and human rights. He will be sharing a presentation, and in the spirit of friendship, I would remind you that that means you have half the time. Matt Pollard is legal advisor to Amnesty International's Counter Terror with Justice campaign. He has served as legal advisor to the Association for the Prevention of Torture and was formerly a constitutional litigator in Canada. He is currently completing a PhD at the University of Essex, where he has also contributed to the forthcoming new edition of Nigel Rodley's Treatment of Prisoners Under International Law. We look forward to that. Thank you to each of you, and we'll proceed with Professor Novak.
Thanks, Lee. Good morning. It's very good to be here again at the Washington University College of Law, which I consider as it is waiting as one of the best law schools, in particular in the field of human rights, not only in the U.S., but I would say worldwide. I have the privilege also to teach. I'm coming back in June in these highly interesting classes here. And I'm also very honored to be invited to speak on this international conference. As you see, my contribution is starting the discussion we are talking, as you said, not only about the international law, but are there adequate legal frameworks in place at the domestic level? And my task is an introduction, what is the international law in this respect? And let's start with the obvious. The prohibition of torture and other forms of cruel, inhuman, degrading treatment or punishment, and I will refer to that as CITT, is one of the very, very few absolute and non-derogable rights, like the prohibition of slavery, slave trade, and very few other rights. And it means that there can be no exceptional circumstances whatsoever, whether it's international or non-international armed conflict, threat of war, riots, terrorism, organized crime, whatever exceptional circumstances that could justify torture or ill treatment. And all attempts to undermine the absolute prohibition of torture, be it by academics, be it by politicians, are just wrong. They are violating a very well-established principle of international law, which is based on very good grounds. Now, this general prohibition is found in most constitutions of the world. At the same time, torture is practiced in most countries of the world, and all too often in a widespread or even systematic manner. So far, in all my fact-finding missions, there was only one country, Denmark, including Greenland, where I didn't find torture. In all the others, I did. In two countries, systematic torture, Nepal and recently Equatorial Guinea. If you look at the inquiry procedure of the Committee Against Torture, they found systematic practice, and that is really the worst in quite a number of countries, including Turkey, Egypt, Peru, and others, Serbia, Montenegro under the Milosevic time. So all too often it is really a widespread practice. So it means there are not adequate legal safeguards in place, and it also meant, in particular, in reaction to the systematic practice of torture in the 1960s, 70s, in the Latin America national security dictatorships, that the United Nations, but also the Organization of American States and others, developed further specialized treaties creating specific legal obligations by states. And I will focus primarily on the United Nations Convention Against Torture, which aimed from 1984, entered into force in 1987, and in principle having three different objectives. The one is fighting impunity, and also other members of this panel will further elaborate on that. Secondly, to provide the victims of torture with the right to remedy and reparation. And thirdly, the prevention, obligations to prevent torture. And I will address them in this order for a short introduction. Fighting impunity means that, and that's for the first time in a classical human rights treaty, that states parties, now we have 145 states parties, have an obligation under Article 4 to ensure that all acts of torture are offenses under its criminal law. And secondly, also, they shall make these offenses punishable by appropriate penalties which take into account their grave nature. So that recognizes that torture is a very, very serious human rights violation which must be made a crime, not just a misdemeanor, a crime under domestic law with appropriate penalties. If you look at the practice of the Committee Against Torture, that doesn't mean a fine or disciplinary punishment. It means several years of imprisonment to be seen as appropriate for the gravity of the offense of torture. But not only making it a crime, but also an obligation to establish comprehensive jurisdiction. That means, of course, first of all, the territorial state has an obligation to also bring perpetrators of torture to justice, but also the nationality state, particularly the active nationality, that means for the United States, if U.S. citizens torture wherever in the world, whether it's in Guantanamo, in Afghanistan, Iraq, wherever, again, the U.S. has an obligation as a state party to the Convention Against Torture to investigate, and if they found enough evidence, to bring them to justice. But in addition, you have the universality principle, and that's what for the first time established as an obligation in an international human rights treaty that comes from the anti-terrorism treaties, but in a human rights treaty, that whenever a person is present on the territory of any of the state's parties, the authorities have an obligation, if there's enough evidence that this person has perpetrated torture, to arrest the person, have a preliminary investigation, and then under the principle aut daedere, aut judicare, decide whether to extradite, but it is only possible if another state is requesting extradition, and if not, then they have to bring this person to justice before their ordinary criminal courts. So that's the obligation which is very, very clear from the law. Now, in practice, I should say that I'm always again astonished how few of those 145 states parties actually have even established the legal framework to implement Article 4 and the following articles. Because it means you have to establish a specific crime of torture in accordance with the definition of torture under Article 1, which is fairly clear and simple. It is the infliction of severe pain or suffering, not extreme pain or suffering, as Mr. Bybee and Mr. Yeo and others felt. It's severe pain or suffering, mental or physical, intentionally, so you can't torture by negligence, intentionally, for a specific purpose, not just any purpose, but extraction of confession. Still, in most countries of the world where torture is practiced, it is the extraction of confession. Or extraction of information, intelligence information. Torture in Guantanamo Bay was not for confessions, but for intelligence information. It might also be punishment, intimidation, discrimination, but specific purposes against a powerless person. That is very important. A person who is in detention, where you know that the torturer has absolute control of over the victim. Very often hooded, blindfolded, in incommunicado detention, in secret places of detention. Often they are handcuffed, shackled, naked. So really to show them you are powerless and we can do with you whatever we want, so you better you go. That's the idea. And there must be a state involvement. It doesn't need necessarily the state officials torture, but usually that's the case, but also acquiescence. If they stand by that private individuals are torturing, that also creates state obligations. So again, very, very few countries have actually criminalized torture with adequate penalties. To just give you my own country as an example, it's up to 2 years. And of course, if death results or serious physical injuries, it might be more. But the fact that torture as such should be criminalized with serious penalties is the situation of powerlessness. Even if you don't have long-term physical injuries amounting to organ failure or whatever was discussed in the US, or long-term mental problems. No, it is this very situation where you then apply electroshocks, etc., waterboarding, etc., that soon reaches the level of severe pain or suffering. Secondly, even if they have the legal framework in place, then often there are no adequate penalties. As I just said, in Austria we had recently a serious case of torture by police for policemen when they wanted to deport a citizen of Gambia. He resisted the deportation and then they seriously punished him and he had own jaws and whatever. And finally, the courts investigated and sentenced those four police officers to 6 or 8 months on probation. That is not what we call an appropriate penalty. But then, of course, if it comes more to universal jurisdiction, it is in fact very often there's again no framework in place. Think about the Habré case before the Committee Against Torture. Mr. Habré, the former dictator of Chad, lived since 1990 in Senegal. Senegal is a state party. They did everything to avoid, actually, to bring this person to justice. And even now, after the committee has clearly said you are violating the convention, it still takes, it's very, very difficult that they actually establish the legal framework for applying universal jurisdiction. Very often, governments don't really understand how data are judicare. They say we are only competent if there is an extradition request, which is ridiculous for universal jurisdiction. Give you another case from my own country. Mr. Al-Duri, the former deputy of Saddam Hussein, was had enough evidence that he was involved in serious torture in 1988 in the Anpol operation against the Kurdish villages, etc. He came in the late 90s to Austria for medical reasons. And again, we requested that he would be detained. and that universal jurisdiction would actually be applied. And the answer of the Minister of Justice was, no, there is no extradition request. So as if Saddam Hussein would actually request the extradition of his deputy to come back to Iraq. It does not make sense. And that's still very often the case, the same what the German government did in the Almatov case, the former Minister of Interior of Uzbekistan, Theo von Bogel-Macri, has had enough evidence that he was responsible for systematic practice of torture, etc. So in fact, we have only very few cases where persons were really brought to justice in accordance with Article 4, even on the territorial principle, and under the universal jurisdiction principle, I think we have a handful of cases, best practice by the UK, the case of Lusada, the former warlord in Afghanistan, who applied for asylum in the UK, and then the Crown Prosecution Service actually went 9 times to Afghanistan to actually secure evidence, and then he was sentenced by a British court to 10 years of imprisonment. So again, my answer, like Sprick said, there is very clear and impunity is one of the main reasons for torture. But the legal frameworks, states are not taking their obligations seriously. Second, the rights of victims to adequate remedy and reparation. Again, the convention is very, very clear. Article 13 clearly says each state party shall ensure that any individual who alleges he has been subjected to torture in any territory under its jurisdiction has the right to complain to and to have his case promptly and impartially examined by its competent authorities. So it means that every allegation of torture needs to be taken seriously. There should be no fear of reprisals by the person who complains. And there should be an investigation. It doesn't have to be immediately a criminal investigation. So what we are asking, for instance, are police, independent investigation authorities, independent also from the police, but who have all the powers of subpoena, etc., in order to investigate. The UK, Ireland, Northern Ireland have good institutions in place, but in most countries it doesn't exist. And if you are in detention, again, it's my experience, if you are in detention, people are just much, much afraid. Secondly, there's the burden of proof. Usually you are tortured in the presence of 5-6 police officers, you alone. How do you prove? If you don't have immediate access to medical or forensic examination to prove actually at least the physical injuries. So it is very, very difficult. There's this esprit de corps among the police. And again, there are not adequate legal frameworks to make sure that people in detention have a possibility to complain and that there's really an investigation. Under, as I said, in any territory under its jurisdiction, of course, again, in the U.S. Context, it means not only U.S. territory, but also Guantanamo Bay, etc. So whenever there's any case that the person alleges that he or she has been subjected to torture, Guantanamo is only he, then there is an obligation to investigate independently and then to take the necessary action. Now, secondly, not just remedy, but also reparation. Victims of torture do have a right under Article 14 to reparation. It can be all forms of reparation. Very often it's the truth that protects the victims is the most important. That governments don't deny, that they investigate and that the truth actually is established. Perhaps also an apology is often a form of reparation. But usually torture victims suffer for the rest of their life. They are in need of rehabilitation measures. Psychologically, medically, socially, etc., rehabilitation measures, long-term. They are very costly, so also right to compensation. And of course, this creates problems, because in the state where torture is practiced systematically or widespread, usually there are no true torture rehabilitation centers available. So what usually happens is actually that the person is trying to escape, fleeing, seeking asylum in another state. But you have this right to reparation against the state that is responsible for torture, not against the asylum state. and with the restrictive asylum policies in Europe and other parts of the world, it's getting more and more difficult than to actually receive rehabilitation. In those countries, there are rehabilitation centers, but you are not granted asylum, you are not taken seriously. You have so many Chechen refugees, for instance, coming to Europe who are traumatized, who are really in need of rehabilitation, and in fact, they are again treated as if they would be criminals sent back to the Russian Federation. So that means also that Article 14 actually should be interpreted, and I read it out. Each state party shall ensure in its legal system that the victim of an act of torture obtains redress and has an enforceable right to fair and adequate compensation, including the means for as full rehabilitation as possible. I think also what we need is not only against the state, but also that torture victims have a right to litigate against the state, but also against the individual perpetrators. So also to develop something that we could call civil, universal civil jurisdiction. Here, the US, the Pilatiga case and others with the Alien Tort Claims Act have really started a very good practice, but there are very few other cases, other countries are following. And recently, the House of Lords in the Jones case has established a very, very negative precedent by saying this was British citizens alleging torture in Saudi Arabia. And then they filed a case in British courts against the state of Saudi Arabia that has said its immunity, but also against its officials. And in my opinion, in a wrong judgment, the House of Lords said that even the individual police officer who was alleged to have perpetrated torture would be immune, in my opinion. That's not right. So I think there's much room for improvement also to really provide the victims not only with a remedy, but also with full reparation for the harm they suffered. Finally, prevention of torture. There are many different obligations in the convention. And I think you have in the materials, at least on the CD-ROM, a recent article I wrote on torture and forced disappearances, and there I have a whole list which are Amnesty made these 12 points. If these are these points of prevention, if they would be taken seriously, we could easily eradicate torture. Just a few of them: prohibition of arbitrary arrest and detention, prohibition of incommunicado detention, secret places of detention, of course, are, and post-disappearances are the ideal situation where torture occurs, comprehensive prison registers, of course, early access to lawyers, doctors, forensic experts, families have a preventive effect. what you just said about the limits of habeas corpus now in relation, and I have read the most recent circuit politics, my opinion is just unbelievable that you say you have been 7 years in detention in Guantanamo Bay, but you have failed actually to apply for immigration under the immigration laws in order that you can be released to the United States of America. So you actually can't be released by the courts. The limit of the length of police custody, when usually it's 48 hours. That the police can keep you. And then you have to be brought before a judge. And the judge decides either there's enough evidence that you can be put in detention on remand, and if not, you have to be released. 48 hours, might be 4 days, Rogan case if it's really terrorism, etc., but not 7 years before you are caught before you're caught. The limit also of pre-trial detention should not be too long, because there's always the risk of subjected to torture. But then, of course, also education, training of law enforcement officials, the review of prison detention rules. Also, in general, keeping places of detention in accordance with minimum conditions of human dignity. It is appalling in many countries where I'm coming, if you look really at the conditions of detention, they amount, in general, to degrading and just the lack of access to food, the lack to any minimum hygienic standards, the lack to any kind of medical facilities. People are really treated as animals, as many people say, and definitely not in a way that one. I think Nelson Mandela once said that very clearly, if you really want to see the culture, the human rights culture of the country, go to the prison. I think it's a good way of getting to know them. Of course, the principle of non-refoulement is very important for the prevention. You're not only under an obligation not to torture yourself, but also not to send a person to any other country where there's a serious risk of torture. And again, it was undermined by these diplomatic assurances, both by the US, but also by many European states, the United Kingdom, Sweden, and others, saying, we know that you torture, but we want to get rid of these dangerous individuals, so please don't torture them, give us the diplomatic assurances, and then you can't monitor it, and we know many cases where persons actually have been sent under diplomatic assurances and afterwards subjected to torture. Of course, the doctrine of the tainted fruits of the poisonous tree, so every information extracted by torture should not be used in any criminal proceedings or any other proceedings, extradition, detention proceedings. If this is taken seriously, then it would be a major incentive, actually, not to practice torture. Again, a major problem that we will face is prosecutions now of persons alleged of having committed terrorist acts. And finally, most importantly, visits to all places of detention. We will hear more about that later. I do consider the optional protocol of the Convention Against Torture as one of the most important new developments. And I would, as we have done on earlier occasions also, very, very strongly urge the US government to consider ratification of this important new treaty, because it goes beyond the European Convention by not only establishing a United Nations subcommittee on the prevention of torture with the right to visit places of detention, but more importantly, it requires every state party to establish an independent national preventive mechanism. That means an independent commission composed of experts, different experts, doctors, psychiatrists, etc., but to carry out regular and ad hoc visits to all places of detention, whether it's prisons, pretrial, police lockups, psychiatric institutions, detention for migrants, minors, etc. If this is done on a regular basis, it actually prevents torture, ill treatment, and forced disappearance, similar violations of human rights. And to finish with what my three predecessors, Sir Nigel Audley, has once said, what we actually need is a paradigm shift from the paradigm of opacity, which still surrounds places of detention, to a paradigm of transparency. In other words, opening up places of detention to the outside, that people can come in. That is the best way of preventing torture. And I'm very grateful to the Association for the Prevention of Torture, the leading non-governmental organizations, in having promoted the development of this important new instrument, but also in now monitoring or assisting in the ratification process, but also in the implementation process. We have carried on joint seminars in certain countries, because again, if we talk about the adequate legal frameworks in place at a domestic level, I am again very discouraged, also by certain European states, to name for instance Germany, who think with a few volunteers, you can actually carry out regular inspections to all places of detention in a country with 80 million inhabitants. It just doesn't work. You need that, costs money, but it is worthwhile if you want to prevent torture. So in other words, if there's the political will, every police chief who wants to eradicate torture can do it within his or her police detention facilities. Every prison director is able. You just have to want it, you have to give the respective orders, and you have to monitor yourself. You can do it yourself. It's very often that they come to a prison where I'm told I've never heard about any kind of torture allegations, and I find within one day of inspection many, many more credible and very often also corroborated allegations of torture than they have found in 10 years before. So that just means the prison director doesn't really take this serious and is not really interested in eradicating. And I think every government, every president of a state can eradicate torture if there is the political will, but I do have to trust in the present U.S. administration that it will do. Thank you.
Pleasure to be here with this very distinguished audience. I want to apologize in advance. I'm going to have to excuse myself a little bit early because the teacher is over to teach a class. As will be clear, I think already is clear from Manfred Novak's remark, international human rights law has long paid special attention to the scourge of torture. As I think many people here know, torture has long been absolutely prohibited by international law. It's banned in all of the major post-war human rights treaties. Despite that, very specialized treaties have been adopted both at the international level, which we've been talking about and we'll hear more about, also at the regional level, to ensure, to minimize the risk of torture and to provide also effective redress when it does occur. When human rights experts talk about these very specialized efforts to go further than the prohibition we find in every human rights treaty, we often find ourselves using the phrase impunity. These measures are meant to end impunity. And indeed, Mr. Novak has now invoked that concept when he said something to the effect, impunity is one of the main reasons we have torture. And we often use the phrase, in fact, culture of impunity, to describe, the conditions in which inhibitions, restraints against torture have been so loosened in a society that people are encouraged, in effect, condoned to commit torture without fear of consequence or serious penalty when they do so. And so, much of human rights law directed at curbing torture is aimed at dispelling what we often call a culture of impunity. As my colleague Rick Wilson mentioned, several years ago I was appointed by then Secretary General of the UN Kofi Annan to update the principles that a United Nations Special Rapporteur, Louis Joinet, had developed a little over 10 years ago, which were aimed at providing guidance for states in combating impunity, not just for torture, but for serious human rights violations and violations of international humanitarian law. And my mandate was very finite and specific. It was to update the principles that Louis Joinet had developed in light of two considerations. First of all, developments in international law since he had prepared his draft, and those developments were quite significant. So my update was meant to reflect an expert assessment of how international law had developed in the years since Louis Joinet had done the first draft. Secondly, they were to reflect the best practice of states in combating impunity, to try to reflect and to distill for states lessons learned from countries that have made vigorous efforts to combat impunity and to try to successfully ensure that torture and other abuses don't occur again. So what I'd like to do is very briefly allude to the four pillars of these principles, which were, in effect, endorsed by the Commission on Human Rights at its last session in 2005, and then home in on two of those core ideas and talk about what relevance they may have for contemporary debates in this country, particularly in this city, about how to deal with our own legacy of torture, a subject of rich debate right now. I want to first acknowledge that I say that these principles may be relevant for our own experience with an awareness that framing policy debates about how to deal with these problems in the United States, framing policy in terms of international law and the lessons of international experience isn't always an approach that has the best traction in persuading policymakers in Washington. But as Manfred Novak has reminded us, and I think other panelists will, the United States has assumed international obligations. It has willingly assumed international obligations, including as a party to the Convention Against Torture. And in one of its earliest executive orders, President Obama reaffirmed the United States' commitment to bring its practices as well as laws in full compliance with our international obligations. It also is the case that relevant principles of international law as well as experience of other states happens to be quite relevant and I think in some ways very helpful in illuminating some contemporary debate. So let me turn to the principles. First, a couple of general points. One is that the principles of the UN on combating impunity don't explicitly address situations of political transition, but many of the principles have a particular relevance during periods in which a government seeks to affirm the rule of law and to prevent future abuses at a time when there's a moment of opportunity, a moment of change, following a period in which systemic abuses have occurred. And so the principles, again, while they're not explicitly addressed to that period, recognize that there are moments of opportunity to turn a corner, and that it's very, very important to seize those moments and make the most of them in order to prevent a recurrence of abuses. Second kind of animating idea behind the principles on impunity is that governments must take effective action across a range of different areas. It's not sufficient simply to criminalize torture and prosecute it when it occurs, for example, but states must take effective institutional reforms. They must take potential measures Manfred Novick talked about. They must ensure redress, reparation for victims, and so forth. So that idea is quite important to the principles overall. So core principles. There are actually 38 principles. In the previous version, there were 42, but they really sift down to four core ideas, which are the right to truth, the right to justice, the right of victims to have an effective remedy and to receive reparations, and the duty of states more broadly to undertake institutional reforms when it is necessary to do so in order to prevent a recurrence of systemic abuses. Since other panelists are addressing in some depth the right to a remedy and reparations and the duty, what the principles call the right to justice, I'm going to focus on the other two core ideas, and I want to start with the right to truth. Chouinard and others have used this term as well as the synonymous term, the right to know, to capture two basic ideas. One is an individual right of victims or their survivors to know the basic facts surrounding the abuses that they suffered personally. There's also a collective dimension to the right to know, or a social dimension, which has to do with the right of a society to have access to information and the corresponding duty of governments to preserve information that sheds light on the underlying causes of systemic abuses that have occurred in the past. And one of the basic ideas behind this collective right to know, it really rests on a fairly rich conception of the right of society to preserve memory and have access to their historical memory. But one of the core ideas relates very much to the subject of this conference, and that is that the public needs to have access to knowledge about the underlying conditions that led to past abuses in order effectively to ensure as citizens that their government does not in the future return to those circumstances. And so it's a tool of empowerment for the society to make sure that governments don't once again continue along a path that has led to abuses. I think that this particular notion has special relevance for a debate that is now underway, as I alluded to earlier. And the debate refers specifically to whether or how the United States should investigate the circumstances that led to the abuses that my colleague Rick Wilson talked about in his introductory remarks. There have been a number of proposals from Congress to set up some variation of a commission of inquiry to look into these abuses. In addition, this past week, several prominent individuals and organizations sent a letter to President Obama calling on him to, quote, appoint a nonpartisan commission of distinguished Americans to examine and provide a comprehensive report on policies and actions related to the detention, treatment, and transfer of detainees after 911 and the consequences of those actions, and to make recommendations for future policy in this area. And I think this proposal really gets the core idea exactly right. What it recognizes is that getting to the bottom of what we did and why and what impact our actions had is a necessary foundation for getting it right in the future. The American public apparently already gets that, according to a poll undertaken by USA Today and the Gallup poll that was taken about a month ago. Almost two-thirds of Americans supported the idea that there should be some kind of investigation into allegations of abuses committed in the post-911 period. In response to one of the proposals that was a proposal by Senator Patrick Leahy, President Obama said something to the effect that his general orientation right now is to say, quote, let's get it right moving forward rather than to look backward. And I hope that in saying this, President Obama meant to signal that whatever action he ultimately takes or endorses, his goal is not to secure some kind of partisan advantage, but rather to ensure respect for the rule of law. He's, of course, President Obama is a great student of American history himself, and as we all know, is a particular fan of Abraham Lincoln. So I think it's worth quoting from what President Lincoln himself said following his second inauguration. He exhorted his fellow citizens to, quote, study the incidents of some of the great trials they had just been through, to learn wisdom from them, and not for the purpose of establishing wrong to be revenge. So the point is to learn lessons for the future, not to exact revenge. Let me turn to steps that the Obama administration has taken. Obviously, the question of how to address these various proposals for commission inquiry is still unresolved. In a very positive step, on his very first full day in office, or one of his first full days in office, President Obama sent a memorandum to heads of executive agencies directing them, while interpreting the Freedom of Information Act, to apply a, quote, clear presumption in favor of disclosure. And I was very impressed to read the first line of this memo. It began, quote, a democracy requires accountability, and accountability requires transparency. Also very important in this regard are several investigations that are still underway, but which were initiated during the Bush administration. For example, I'm sure many of you have read about a study by the Justice Department's Office of Professional Responsibility, which is now in the final stages. According to news reports, this study, quote, and I'm quoting from the New York Times, sharply criticizes Bush administration lawyers who wrote legal opinions justifying waterboarding and other harsh interrogation practices. It's not yet clear whether the Obama administration will release this report or a summary of it in the interest of transparency. I hope that they do. A number of other investigations are underway, including, I believe, an investigation into the decision by the CIA to destroy video recordings of interrogations that may have included torture. Let me move to the final category that I want to briefly touch on in the interest of time. The last broad category of measures to combat impunity in the UN principles, as I mentioned earlier, is essentially that states should take an array of measures aimed at guaranteeing non-recurrence of human rights violations. And these are, broadly speaking, the kinds of measures that Manfred Novak referred to toward the end of his own remark under the broad heading of prevention. Now, obviously, all of these other measures, such as criminalizing torture, et cetera, are also measures of prevention. But there are certain kinds of institutional reforms that is appropriate for states to undertake, particularly when there has been a period of systemic breakdown that has led to serious abuses. Within the concept of the U.S. Principles on Impunity, these kinds of measures include institutional measures, reforms, and other measures necessary to ensure respect for the rule of law, foster and sustain a culture of respect for human rights, and restore or establish public trust in government institutions. The UN will go on to say that the aim of these measures should be to advance consistent adherence by public institutions to the rule of law, ensure and toward this end, recommend that when appropriate, a government should undertake a comprehensive review of legislation and administrative regulations that may have contributed to past violations, and take a range of other measures that I won't go into. In this regard, some of the first actions taken by President Obama really go some distance already in the direction of these kinds of guarantees of non-recurrence. On his second day of office, as was already mentioned, President Obama signed an executive order to close Guantanamo to require the CIA to use the same non-coercive interrogation methods that the U.S. military is required to use, to report all detainees to the International Committee of the Red Cross, and to provide timely access by the ICRC to detainees. He also ordered the closing of the CIA's secret overseas detention program, and he ordered that a special task force be established to study and evaluate interrogation practices, and practices concerning the transfer of individuals to other countries with a view toward ensuring that they are not tortured, and also to ensure that the United States does not violate our domestic or international legal obligations. These measures are very much in the spirit of the UN principles on combating impunity, particularly the last category that I mentioned. Going forward, and building on these steps, I would like to say in closing, I think it's critically important that the administration insist on one core principle, and this is an important principle to insist on in order to resist some of the pressures that the administration clearly is already facing. And that principle is that enforcing the law against torture is not, and emphatically is not, a form of partisan payback. In fact, it's important to constantly remind the public it's just the opposite. This passionate fidelity to the rule of law, and not incidentally to the most cherished values of our country, is what's at stake, and not partisanship. Thank you.
Ambassador Gallegos and Dean Grossman.
Be very careful because Dean Grossman is also my boss. Thank you for this invitation to the law school, and thank you for ATP on this invitation. It's an honor to be here and a pleasure to be in academia. My realm of profession takes me into the reality more than anything else, political issues. So I will be touching on a few elements which I think are pertaining to our experience in the committee on this issue. First of all, of course, we're talking about normative incorporation. And you can see the convention in Article 1, 3, 3, 4, 5 to 15, all of them have issues of incorporation. I'd like to present you with various scenarios. One of them, of course, is that the state incorporated. But as you just heard, special rapporteur, the majority of the 145 countries have not, or are unwilling to, or are not in their capacity of criminalizing this as much as we would wish. Some of them have done it partially, which I would call the second category, incomplete incorporation. Incomplete incorporation means that it's not in their constitutional framework, it's in a secondary law, in a procedural law, in a criminal law. It might not even be in any of those. We've had experiences of countries coming to us to report that they are in the process. So the third category might be, given the doubt, that they will be in the process. And there is, of course, those who simply do not have them. Simply do not have them in their legal framework. It's the concept of torture. Although they have signed the convention, and we have 145 states, that means around 70% of the 192 countries that form the United Nations that have signed this convention. The guidelines that the committee has since 1991 and 1998, you can see the relevant documents on this, are fundamentally to ask the countries to incorporate
justice had recommended they do report. So the committee, every time Humphrey sits down to report, to comply with the obligation to report, has to analyze and explain why it has not reported. And I think the rapporteurs and co-rapporteurs are very insistent on the procedure of why they have not incorporated this into their legal claim. The actual issue also has to do with jurisdiction. Mr. Novak also mentioned the jurisdiction of territoriality and universal jurisdiction. So I do think that we are touching upon the basis of what we would call the political will of states. Are states willing to do this? Of course, you have to have a principle that states sign the treaty and their parliaments, in the majority of cases, ratify. Are they willing? Do they have the political will to apply this? Knowing that most of the states in the world, or governments in the world, are not like to be monitored by international conventions, or international conventions in this case, who set up a body of experts. Today, the first meeting of the Committee Against the Human Rights Convention on Persons with Disability is meeting in Virginia. I think that that's a step in the right direction. As we have these treaty bodies which comply with enforceable obligation of states, the states have signed this, they have ratified them, they have to comply with it. But to your surprise and mine, I would say that many of them don't. So if you wish to look into this in a broader sense, you can probably go to the last report of the committee, and you will find the number of countries that have not even presented their first reports. And I was looking into this. I'm not a mathematician. I became a lawyer because I was bad at it. I would say that there are 38 countries that have not presented their initial reports. There's second periodic reports, 56 countries have not. The third periodic report, 56 countries. Fourth periodic reports, 43. Fifth periodic reports, 33. And the sixth periodic report, 32. So if you add up the numbers, a large number of countries are not reporting. They're not reporting on this convention. But the problem is that we have a major backlog on reporting in all conventions. So the Secretariat is backlogged, and so are the committee. We have something like 40 reports of countries that we have not been able to deal with in the Committee Against Torture. Maybe Zhao can give us a more precise number of that, but fundamentally, the committee would have to duplicate its sessions in order to consider those reports, and not only duplicate them, but be more effective, which is another issue of how the committees that monitor these conventions are not operating in an effective sense. Let me put it in a framework of an anecdotal experience. If somebody is tortured today, by the time the committee needs to deal with this thing, it might take years. So we need a more effective system of monitoring. We need a more effective system of having the states comply with their international law. Of course, you have to be also very proactive here. We've heard that of the nature. I would like to divide this into three aspects. Technical assistance. I do think that the Committee Against Torture has to have the capabilities, resources, both human and financial, to give states technical assistance in the compliance of the convention. I'm not talking about OPCAT in the sense of prevention. I think that is a very valuable step in the issue of preventing. But I think the actual problem is that we have torture. And as the Special Rapporteur has just said, it is generalized, sometimes systematic, and we are not getting to the roots of how to eliminate it. As I just confessed to you, and most of you are here, I am a lawyer. But I don't believe the majority of problems are solved by laws. There has to be a change in society. In order to change society's mentality toward torture, or human degrading, human cruel and degrading treatment, you have to change how society perceives this in its interior essence. And that is the change we are looking for. It is in the realm of human rights, a revolutionary proposal to change society. You do it by establishing a legal framework, of course. But you have to change the way an individual looks at it, a family looks at it, and society looks at it. I think that you have to also have a conscious building effort in the world. And we were just talking about the issues of how this torture and other treatments have been dealt with in the last few years of the terrorist regime. Let me say that as a practitioner, I also deal with this in another sense, because I meet and find sometimes that governments have verbal agreements on intelligence, which I find very disturbing. I do not condone the ability of intelligence services of having verbal agreements. The accountability of a democracy is that the civil authorities, democratically elected, can overview the procedure in which their police forces or military are working. And coming from Latin America, I think Claudio will agree with me, we have been subject to dictatorships which have a very long span of activities and have been including the eruption of institutionalization of democratic institutionalization. And having shared the time with the dean, I have to be very careful on my time. I'd like to conclude with three major issues. First of all, we need to promote the political will of state parties. And the only way a state party does this, if civil society, NGOs, and political institutions prompted to do it. If you do not have that, you will not have the state moving in the right direction. This can be done in a democracy. The majority of countries of the world, I hope, are democracies, but everyone has its particularity. So everyone, in a sense, is something that we should work on building. The resources. We need financial, human and financial resources in order for these committees to work adequately, but for others to apply the commissions in their own territorial states to do this. So as we broaden the individual commissions to deal with this in the territories or universal jurisdiction, we have to be able to prompt that capability. And we have to be able to frame the issue of this, what we are dealing with, when we talk about torture, when we talk about cruel, inhuman, and degrading treatment, as a vision of societies, as a vision of how societies comply with them. And we have to try to do something that is very difficult in government, and that is what most impressed me as in the Obama memorandum: transparency. Can we get at truth through government transparency? Do we have the capability of having agreements that are negotiated and signed, that are not under the board, that are not capable of rendition, or jails flying in the skies, or that have the capability of looking into this in a democratically framed institutional way? If we are capable of that, I think the committees can work better. But in the backlog of this committee, the Committee Against Torture, which I belong to, the only way we can do this is to stress the compliance of countries to do this and civil societies to accompany us in this effort. Thank you very much.
Let me start commenting, first of all, the importance of the incorporation of the treaty obligations in domestic reality. First, there are technical reasons why this is important. Traditional mechanisms of supervision in international forms are weak. You have horizontal supervision when there is a violation of international obligation. You have other countries that would claim that that obligation has an impact on them, and then exercise the means established by international law to redress that wrongdoing. But there are technical issues there, and some obligations are owners, and again, human rights obligations perhaps respond to the obligations of the owners. But again, anyone who knows that the policymakers have been captured by the paradigm of Morgenthau, that of the realism and the role of human rights, and it will play not the most central role in the way it is defined. You go to policymakers and tell policymakers this is the right thing to do, they will tell you, well, perhaps you have the wrong profession. You want to work in academia, or you want to work with a non-governmental organization. And then You see, we need to broaden the scope of this idea that it's important to do the right thing. It's a value in itself. But realistic, we can see the limits, I would say, of classic international law and the system of diplomatic protection and when the function depends on many reasons, strategic, political. Then we have supervisory order that can play a role at the international level. And certainly, you know, we have seen the international organs, some are political organs, the General Assembly of the Organization of American States or the United Nations, and they had the problem that politics have. Again, there have been attempts to restrict the influence of politics, resorting to a classic means of parliamentary diplomacy, having open debates, record keeping, you know, and then all transparency in decision making. And that certainly enhances the possibility of accountability. But the best way to supervise compliance with international obligations is not political organs because of the problems you imagine and you can read about them. But the best way at the level of international supervision is judges-like organs, semi-judicial and judicial, composed by independent agents. But again, usually these organs work as a subsidiary component of supervision, because there are technical requirements of exhaustion of local revenue. And we know, because we wanted to prevent torture, that because of lack of funding and so on and so on, and the technicalities, it lasts years before you can get what is very important. And the promise of the International Bill of Rights continues to be affirmed, unfortunately, really. Societies are willing and unable to solve the problems, you know. We see that in particular in the emergency situation. I mean, I don't want to play the role of somebody who has seen already too much, but after 8 years in the Inter-American Commission, you know, I have a sense of déjà vu when we see this emerging. You know, that the populations are here, the governments, you know, lack many times the political wisdom. We see that short-term solutions are long-term problems. Very few people. They develop a Kantian ethical approach to this issue at Kinder School. I will say, more likely than not, with hindsight, all these issues will surface later and bring tremendous issues. And I'm thinking of so many countries in this hemisphere that in the heat of emergencies, the domestic judiciary that will play a role. And then, as it happens, you know, after the Second World War, the whole of the possibilities of doing something based on this international. But again, I'm mentioning there are limits of what this international organization can do, and then that's the importance of strengthening the incorporation of treaty obligations in domestic. We are preventing to avoid to get to situations where politically society will be confronted with choices that are. It's very difficult. There is another thing that is crucial here. The importance to take law seriously. That has certainly very valuable national security component. When we're talking, for example, about the American Convention on the Prohibition of Extortion, wouldn't it be great if we could convince human beings of the world where we have institutions and judiciary and the tolerance that comes from all these concepts? I mean, there is certainly a utilitarian reason of the highest sort in terms of the regulatory challenge that is necessary to confront very serious challenges. So the need to take the rule of law seriously is, again, we need to talk about this a little bit. Nobody has forced the country to ratify the Convention Against Torture, for example, or the American Convention of Human Rights, or the International Canon on Civil and Political Rights. Yes. Norms are so clear. They are clear, in particular, when we have some level of independent adjudication. In this law school and in other law schools, and that's very valuable for democracy, we train people to argue anything. And sometimes to argue is easier than to collect stones, because if you collect stones, they drop you in a toe and you go to the hospital. But we can argue everything, and if there is not an instance that decides this, all what rests is the art. So that's the importance then of the international provisions. But also the importance of domestic judiciaries that will apply the law as it has been freely accepted and agreed by those who accepted this obligation. And the consequences of not taking the law seriously are dramatic. Our experience with impunity in the Western Hemisphere, I mean, everyone has thought about this, is that impunity is like pregnancy. You cannot have a person pregnant 5%. If you exclude areas of the conduct of the, you know, of the legal system of impunity, you have an overall problem of corruption. And again, perhaps it won't happen everything. Nothing happens in every location. But the value of this notion is the following: that more likely than not, and that's why they are important and they are the guide for behavior, by not following this norm, you create a serious problem in terms of the civilized, let me say, conduct of a human affair, which is very relevant and important for those who believe in the rule of law and in a private society with private things, you know, individuals that would depend on their rule of law. Well, let me say a couple of things within these 10 minutes, because I have been so intimidated by my colleagues here that I'm going to finish while we have some things to do. I would say the following. Let me see. As we're looking at to the incorporation of into a metric legal realm of obligation, we need to start talking also about the transformation of classic international law. Because in classic international law, you know, the issue of incorporation in the domestic realm of international obligation was purely a domestic issue or a constitutional issue. And certainly, that was fine when, you know, all the countries were self-dependent and the connections among countries was open. So we had, but even at that time, we had different legal theories, dualism versus monism, and the theory of self-execution. But the structure of international law was dictated by the nature of international obligation at that time. You know, you sell me oil, I pay you. If you don't sell, if you don't give me the oil, I won't pay you, and so on. But now we have this treaty that says, you shall not torture. You shall not commit genocide. So, classic international law said, you violated the classic international treaty, you have retaliation, reprisal. You cannot say, you kill my gypsies, I kill yours. I mean, these are treaties with a different purpose, the first, a humanitarian purpose, that should be interpreted in accordance, again, with its purpose, in accordance with the Vienna Convention, which is humanitarian. So, that we need to talk about whether the international structure of the body concerning this treaty that have been validly ratified. This is, countries might decide not to do it, but they have done. Second thing, I also believe in the power of law and legitimacy. The law creates space for transformation. Not in every condition, not in every situation, but I think all of us who care about this thing need to push for the idea that rights need to be taken seriously. Words matter. Famous philosophers have said that the language in the house of being, we communicate, and again, we believe in free society, the rule of law, the power of communication, and the extra legitimacy given by the rule of law is essential. And all of this goes into the direction of internal incorporation. In order to prevent, to avoid situations that make every choice bad. And the prevention means, for me, the following: direct applicability of international obligations with the power of individuals to go to a judge when their rights have been violated. I mean, that's the ultimate goal, and we need to work in that direction. Now, we have very positive examples coming, very extended, but I want to mention two that I think are particularly important in the United States, and some of my colleagues have mentioned those, and I will be finishing with this. One is the case of Charles Chakri Taylor, Jr., the son of the former Liberian President Charles Taylor, who was tried on the Torture Victim Protection Act in the United States. and that is a very important historical moment. And I mean, he was sentenced by the U.S. District Court Judge Cecilia Mantonaga to 97 years in prison for crimes involving the torture of people in Liberia between April 1999 and July 2003. This is a very important decision. I think we need to study it and see the power of the incorporation of these non-elected as in the criminal law. And the other thing is the line of decisions under the Pilar. An alien can sue an alien for a tort only committed in violation of the law of nation. And then we have this case of the individual who in the streets of New York recognized the torture of his son, the torture of his son, he died. And then that opened a line in a line of cases. And again, we're dealing here with processes. And these processes are very valuable, very important. And I think we need to push for them. I'm going to finish my comment by reading as we are talking about these legal matters, this is not only about law, it is also about politics. And this norm plays a role in the sense that becomes part of the legal issue, of the political and legal debate of the society. And in the Western tradition, because everything has a legal component, arguing legally then plays a role also politically in the sense of shaping institution. And then the current moment where we are and where we are debating the incorporation of legal norms into domestic law should not obscure the fact that there is a political connotation. The failure to incorporate and the problems that result from the incorporation create space or diminish space for change in human society. We have a political truth with the legal connotation. And then that is something that goes beyond the technicalities of ratification or applying things by executive fiat, but it's also the role that judges creatively can play, I mean, and lawyers and NGOs and academics that would make a difference. And no one with less authority than the Supreme Court Justice Breyer has argued for the validity of this process of incorporation by discussion, by presentation, before the judiciary and by interpretation. He said the transnational law that is being created is not simply a product of treaty writers, legislatures, or courts. We in America know full well that in a democracy law, perhaps most law is not decreed from on high, but bubbles up from the interested public, affected groups, specialists, legislatures, and others, all interacting through meetings, journal articles, the popular press, legislative hearings, and in many other ways. That is the democratic process in action. Legislation typically comes along after this process has been underway. Again, the change is easier when it could take the reality away. And then the judge is preparing by this way. Judicial decisions, particularly from our court, work best when they come last, after the experience has made the consequence of legislation apparent. So our own discussions could be a contribution to that direction. Thank you very much.
Hi. Actually, I had a PowerPoint presentation, but I understand we're squeezed for time, so maybe I'll just start, and if whoever fires up the presentation gets it to join me midway through, that's great, and if not, that's okay, too. And also, thanks very much to both the Law School and the APP for inviting me to speak today. There are some materials on the CD-ROM, an academic study from a couple years ago of Committee Against Torture Decisions that forms a sort of evidentiary basis for my presentation, and also a copy of the presentation. So if someone tackles me midway through to stop me talking because we're out of time, please have a look at the CD-ROM and see what I was going to say. Okay.
No tackling. I'm not doing any tackling.
Basically, what I'm going to be talking about is, first of all, where does the obligation to make torture a specific offense in domestic law come from? What is the scope of jurisdiction that has to be established for that offense in domestic law? And then I'll speak about putting that into practice in domestic law, in domestic practice in terms of mandatory investigation and arrest and prosecution and extradition. So in terms of the obligation itself, and the sources of the obligation. The first and perhaps oldest place are the Geneva Conventions. So the Geneva Conventions, as you probably know, set out, each of them sets out a provision of grave breaches. Yes, so each one has a grave breaches provision, and these I've also excerpted and put into a document in the CD-ROM. And torture and other inhumane treatment of prisoners, unlawful confinement in terms of civilians, are covered by those grave breaches provisions. And those require that alleged perpetrators be searched for by the state, and then similar to what we'll look at under the Convention Against Torture, be either prosecuted or extradited. So very similar to what was eventually enacted for torture in the Convention Against Torture. On the plus side, the Geneva Conventions have been essentially ratified by every country in the world. So in that sense, they're a good source. On the other hand, on their face, of course, they only apply to the great breaches provisions only apply to international armed conflicts. Now, as regards non-international armed conflicts, as you'll know from Supreme Court judgments here and elsewhere, there are other arguments under customary international law regarding those. But the other major limitation is that on its face, again, those grave breaches provisions apply only to protected persons under each convention, and you have to look under the convention for the definition. So it doesn't apply all the time everywhere, and it doesn't necessarily apply to everyone. The International Covenant on Civil and Political Rights, its provision on torture and ill treatment simply says no one shall be subjected to torture or cruel and human degrading treatment or punishment. But the Human Rights Committee under the treaty has interpreted that as incorporating a requirement to bring perpetrators to justice. In fact, in a particular case, torture case, Rajat Pakse versus Sri Lanka in 2006, it actually found Sri Lanka to be in violation for having failed its duty to prosecute and punish the perpetrator of torture under the Covenant on Civil and Political Rights. But again, there's nothing actually written into the covenant about it, so states say, thank you, experts, esteemed experts, but we respectfully disagree with you, and then you sort of have an impasse again. Customary international law is another possible source, although most people think that in terms of the obligation to criminalize and punish and so on, it's permissive. Rather than mandatory. But interestingly, I think it was Professor Novak referred to the case in Senegal of someone named Aubrey, his son Aubrey, who was accused of crimes against humanity, including torture, in Chad. He's currently under house arrest in Senegal, and Belgium has been seeking to sort of have him extradited to the prosecutor for some time. Last Thursday, they filed an application to the International Court of Justice against Senegal, relying in part on customary international law, saying that it actually imposes a mandatory obligation to have the prosecutor extradite. But they're also relying on the explicit provisions of the convention, which we'll come to and will form basically the rest of my presentation. So the Convention Against Torture has the most explicit sort of code of criminalization, most detail. It expressly addresses both war and peacetime. It has, I think, maybe another state party who must have joined in the last few weeks, but when I checked on the weekend, it now has 146 state parties. So adding to your workload, I'm afraid. Now, in fact, the convention itself doesn't specifically say that there must be a distinct offense or definition in domestic law. But certainly the committee has consistently, if you look at that academic article, I mean, in dozens and dozens of instances, specifically stated that it interprets the convention that way, that there must be a separate definition of separate offense of torture. So it's not enough to just say, well, any act of torture will be covered by our general offense of assault, which many countries claim. I think that there's very good reason to accept this interpretation of the convention. First of all, as we'll see in a moment, the convention requires states to specifically eliminate certain defenses to an act of torture, which usually apply to all all offenses in their criminal code. So how can you possibly make it inapplicable to torture if you don't define what torture is, a distinct offense? Also, the issue of the sentencing range that Professor Novak mentioned, how are you going to define an appropriate sentencing range for torture if you don't mention torture in your criminal code? And how are you going to establish very few countries have international global jurisdiction over a simple assault. So how are you going to clearly establish that jurisdiction if you don't define torture under your laws at all? So basically, the approach taken by the committee is that you don't have to have the definition that appears in Article 1 of the Convention verbatim in your laws, but you certainly can't have some definition that leaves out this. That is, it must cover at least everything that's covered by the Convention definition. Now, the key elements were mentioned by Professor Novak. Basically, the ones that I focus on here is severe pain and suffering for certain purposes. I'll just note that in the definition in the convention, it says that it excludes pain and suffering inherent in or incidental to lawful sanctions. And this is generally interpreted by experts, at least, to mean lawful under international law. So a state can't say, well, that particular type of torture, which you're calling torture, is actually provided for in our national laws, therefore excluded from the definition of the convention, and therefore no problem. That would obviously completely undermine the purpose and object of the treaty, for one thing. But also, if you go back and look at the Declaration on Torture that the General Assembly passed in 1975, it also had a similar concept, but it specifically referred to incarceration that complies with UN standard minimum rules. And I think that's the best way to understand what does it mean to say pain and suffering inherent to the lawful sanctions of the suit. Well, you know, there may be some pain and suffering, mental pain and suffering involved in being incarcerated, you know, in fully in compliance with human standards, and that is excluded from the definition. I think it's also important to note that the convention specifically requires states not only to criminalize the person, the act of actually inflicting the pain and suffering, but also attempt, complicity, or participation in an act of torture. Now, often these concepts, whether they're called aiding or abetting or accessory or something in national law, already exist. But, you know, it has to be clear that whatever concept is applying at the national level, at least it covers everything that is meant by the treaty itself when it says complicity participation. I've just noted here, and I put excerpts in the materials of two cases from the Criminal Tribunal for Former Yugoslavia specifically addressing the question of what does it mean to be aiding and abetting an act of torture in international law. Now, in terms of the absoluteness of the prohibition at the national level, the convention is clear that no exceptional circumstances whatsoever may be invoked as justification for an act of torture. Specifically lists state of war, threat of war, internal political instability, or any other public emergency. So what is the implication of that for domestic law? Well, as I say, many national criminal codes will have general defenses of necessity or defense of self, defense of others, and so on, in situations of duress. And clearly, those have to be somehow made inapplicable to the offense of torture in order to meet this requirement of the convention and to comply with the absoluteness of the prohibition that Professor Novak mentioned, more generally the case under international law. The convention also specifically says an order from a superior officer or public authority may not be invoked to justification for torture. Again, these are often, especially with assault, in order that every time a policewoman uses force, they aren't accused of assault in the criminal prosecution. There are often certain defenses set out for those public authorities. Those must somehow be made inapplicable to torture in national law. But with jurisdiction, as was mentioned, you have a territorial foundation. At least act of torture carried out on your territory must be covered by your criminal law. Also, Professor Novak said, if you got an astronaut on the moon who tortures another astronaut, if he's an American, the U.S. criminal code must somehow apply. But also, if an offender from any country, from torture, someone in any country who is a national of any country comes into your territory, you have to be prepared in your national law such that you can exercise criminal jurisdiction over the person. Now, it's not only that you have to be ready with the offense sitting in your national law. The convention says if you wind up in that situation, someone is on your territory who is accused of an act of torture, you are required to take them into custody or otherwise ensure their presence, first of all. Interestingly, in that International Court of Justice application that's just been filed, Belgium is asking the court to order provisional measures, like an interim injunction, that Senegal is bound to ensure that Abre is kept under house arrest or otherwise unable to escape from the country. Then the state who has then taken that person into custody has to inquire into the facts and notify and report promptly the results to other countries. And again, this applies not only to the person who actually inflicted the pain and suffering, but others who were involved through complicity or participation. And then at the heart of this scheme, which at the time was sort of described as we want to make sure there is no safe haven anywhere in the world for torturers, is the obligation to prosecute or extradite. It's an either-or proposition. You know, either you must prosecute the person yourself. The only other possibility is if someone else is seeking extradition and the person can be extradited there. And again, these are specific provisions that Belgium is relying on in its case against Senegal, saying you are obliged under the Convention Against Torture to either prosecute this person or send him to us. You've done neither, therefore you're in violation of your obligations to us under the convention. The convention also says that the case, it doesn't actually say that the case must be brought to prosecution and trial and the person convicted. It doesn't say that. It says that the case must be submitted to the competent authorities for the purpose of prosecution, and they must take their decision in the same manner as in the case of any ordinary offense of a serious nature under the law of that state. In other words, you can't apply a lower standard or a higher standard. You can't, you know, apply some kind of political criteria, etc., as to whether to take forward the torture prosecution. You have to have proper evidence. You can't necessarily just sort of file newspaper reports or a book and say there, you have to prosecute. You know, it has to be a proper criminal case. Well, just to maybe, since a few others, since we're in the United States, I mean, obviously everything I've said applies to every one of the 146 countries who's a party to the convention. But in the particular case of the U.S., I think there's a few things, it's too bad we don't have more time left for questions, but a few things to think about. Obviously, the executive orders on a going forward basis are very positive and encouraging, but some problems remain that have to be addressed, which are probably, some of which are probably obvious to you now. First of all, at the time that the U.S. ratified the convention, the Senate stated certain understandings it had about the definition of torture, and particularly about what it means to say mental pain and suffering, severe mental pain and suffering related to torture, under the definition in the convention. And those understandings have found their way into the definitions of torture in U.S. criminal law. And that, it's not obvious that that will change with the executive order. That's in congressional statutory legislation. There is also a statutory defense that was slipped into the 2005 Detainee Treatment Act for anyone who is accused of wrongful actions vis-a-vis detainees who are suspected of terrorism. It basically is kind of a due diligence defense. It says if you didn't know that it was wrong to do that to the person, it was unlawful to do that to the person, and a reasonable person would have known that it was unlawful to do that to a person, then you have a defense to criminal and civil responsibility. And it specifically says, you know, the fact that you relied on legal advice shall be relevant in that. So, to me, there's very little space in the convention to allow for a defense of due diligence or ignorance of the law for torture, especially when, as far as I understand, the reason they needed to enact that is because it exists for no other similar offense in the law. So I think that that is probably another area for attention, potential inconsistency with these obligations. Finally, we have the admissions by state officials before Congress, that indeed some individuals were subjected to waterboarding, at the same time denying that it constituted torture under U.S. law. We also have the admission of the convening authority at Guantanamo Detention Center that one of the cases was indeed stopped because she concluded the person had been tortured. As you can see under the convention, once you have, in these cases, public acknowledgments of this, certain machinery is supposed to start operating. Now, perhaps it's operating behind closed doors, I'm not aware of it. But, you know, weeks have gone by with no further comment on it, so I would suggest that those are other questions that need to be asked about domestic legal framework in the U.S. So, thanks very much.
Didn't exercise that usual moderator's prerogative to pass a little note to the speakers. I think this panel was particularly equipped to start off the day. I wanted to give them ample space to make their presentations, and it puts us up against the time limit that we have set for this particular session. So I think I'm going to exercise my prerogative, ask you to hold your questions during the break. We're going to take a 10-minute break now, and if you would like to speak to the folks who presented, you may do so, and we want to thank them one more time.